First of all, there are no rules. Why you're going to get picked or why you're not going to get picked is completely arbitrary. And then the methodology by which you're going to get your stuff created, surround yourself with good people. If you actually get hired for something, find good people, hire them, and use them so that you have the experience and the benefit of people who can help you get through those technical hurdles until you can do it on your own.
That's John March. I'm Steve Cleveland, and this is Sync Club. We're back with the second half of our interview with David Bondolevich and John March.
And that thing about demos, I have had, or I've seen artists who, if someone asks them, oh, do you have anything that we could use in this show, they'll turn over their latest rehearsal recording from Zoom H2, or they'll turn over a public performance that was recorded from the back of the room. And again, first impressions can't be changed. If someone hears that, especially someone who's not a musician or a recording engineer, they're just going to think it sounds bad, and they're not going to think about your music. So it does have to be presented very professionally. Speaking of professionally, you brought up naming of tracks. Steve.
Oh, right, yeah, that's one of the questions that I had.
There is, as far as I know, no standard for delivery. Some mixers will tell the composer, please name the tracks this, and sometimes the composer will listen and sometimes they won't. The only places that I've seen file names be important is actually the final version of the master that either goes to television or to the theater for a digital cinema print. Those have to follow an extremely specific file naming convention, and the file names are like 256 characters long with all this information jammed together. Mm-hmm. That's useful for the technical reasons of the masters, but it's not useful for the mixer. I just want to see the tracks named with what they are. So if you've done four splits on your rock and roll band, and one of them's drums, and one of them's guitar, and one of them's bass, and one of them's keyboards, that's fine. Just name them that.
Okay.
John, do you have any...
I was just thinking as you were talking, my son is a voiceover and a theater person and film person. And he recently got an opportunity to audition for a fairly large animated TV series. And, you know, he didn't read the call as carefully as he should have. And so he was in a rush. And so he was visiting his grandparents and they needed it right away. So he took his phone out to the garage and, you know, he did the read and sent it in. And then of course, 5 minutes after he sent it in, he read the instructions and it was like, don't do it in a reverberant space. You know, I'm not going to even consider you if there's any echo. And, you know, the poor guy was like, you know, it was the producer knows him and likes him and wanted him in the show. But the supervisor basically just didn't even listen because as soon as she heard the echo, she turned it off and kind of that was it. Those kinds of things are part of the learning process. In terms of naming conventions, you know, I name for the way my brain works and then I follow the requirements of the deliverable. So if I'm working, I have my own naming conventions that I can follow very quickly. But as soon as I know I'm going to deliver like a Pro Tool session or a mix or whatever it is, I have a deliverable spec that I get from the client and I am assiduous and very, very careful about making sure that I follow that to the letter, like very, very, very careful about that.
So here's a parallel from cutting sound effects. When you're naming sound effects to put in a library, it's really important because you're going to search by adjective mostly. So if you're doing something like a carby, you don't name it carby. You start at the least specific and work your way to the most specific. So it's carby, Honda, Accord, 2012, left to right at 40 miles per hour, which is a lot of information to fit in a track name. Obviously, that would all go in the metadata as well. But when you're searching, sometimes the track name is the easiest place to find that. So the same thing with music. Figure out what your nomenclature is going to be and stick to it. So if you're delivering a cue, a composed cue, and it has a number, 1M4, that should go at the beginning. And you should probably make it 0104 so that they alphabetize correctly and numerically. And then from there on, say what the track is. Castanets or group percussion, whatever it's going to be. That will help a lot. And one thing you never want to do in your file nomenclature, never name something final. You are tempting the gods if you name it final. So I'll look at
with this one and say I name final all the time. Just saying.
Yes,
just
but saying. You don't have as many people telling you to redo it.
No, I get people. I think I just did three documentaries for AEG. AEG Presents, which is a local big producer, and I did there for Red Rocks, and it was a biography about Chuck Morris, a history of KBCO, and a documentary about the Jazz Masters that all come out of Colorado. And I mixed all of them, and my obsessiveness was, you know, I would go final and deliver to the, you know, editors for rendering, and then I'd go back like after lunch and I would hear my mix and I go nope, and I'd remix it and I go final 01,
right,
you know, and final 02. And my guys, the editors who know me, know that until I actually call and say, all right, I'm done, I can't deal with this anymore, they'll just keep holding a little space for me, right. You know, up until the last possible minute.
But of course, if someone's quickly trying to find something and they see something that says final, they're unlikely to look any further.
That's correct.
So I very strongly encourage people not to put version numbers, but to instead put the date. And if you do multiple in the same day, put the time, because then you'll be able to sort them very quickly by what was most recently finished.
Sure. That makes sense. Yeah. Now, I do know that having known people that have taken David's class, that he would never just stop with like his car by example. It would be like tire brand, winter snow tires with a tread depth of like what, like 2/32.
If you're going for tire squeals, yes, I would absolutely put that in.
I use SoundMiner, David. So yes. I'm just much lazier than you. I go to my spot, mark my spot for entry for design, and then I'll type in, you know, door, and then I'll start looking through doors.
Right.
I think I'm lazier than most. I think that I understand your methodology, and I agree 100% for people who are starting out. And then there's this whole process of like, well, what's your workflow methodology and how do you get to where you need to go?
A lot of it also has to do with how many libraries you're using. If you're in Hollywood and you're working for one of the big companies, you have probably 400 libraries you're searching from hundreds of thousands of sounds. So if you're looking for something very specific, like a single cricket in a concert hall, of course you could just add the reverb, but if you're looking for something really specific, having all those adjectives really does help. And sometimes I have to spell things multiple ways. So, for instance, a sword being unsheathed is called a schwing. But is that S-C-H or is that S-H? So in the metadata, I'll make sure both words are there, both spellings are there. And refrigerator, anybody who looks it up with a D, even though there is no D in refrigerator. So I put that spelled wrong.
That's really funny.
Yeah, that's good.
That's
tip.
Really funny.
Good tip.
Do you want to talk about like the indie thing? Like, I mean, I know so many young artists, you know, that I talk to, like when I come down and talk to the kids in your class, or when I talk to, you know, young musicians a lot, you know, they're always worried about something. I think it has to do with that. A lot of the craft of what you and I came up on, which was based on, it wasn't so easily accessible to get to gear or to operations or to tools or even mentors or teachers, that they're much more focused on the way that the tool functions rather than being able to get a result based on some sense of craftsmanship. And I'm just want to make sure we're addressing the needs of somebody who's listening to this, who's starting out as an indie songwriter or an artist or who wants to get involved. And we're able to say, first of all, there are no rules.
Right.
Why you're going to get picked or why you're not going to get picked is completely arbitrary. And then the methodology by which you're going to get your stuff created, surround yourself with good people. If you actually get hired for something, find good people, hire them and use them so that you have the experience and the benefit of people who can help you get through those technical hurdles until you can do it on your own. You know, don't try and be everything all at once. It's you know, it took me 40 years to be a good session musician, a good mixer and producer, to the point where I'm comfortable doing any of those roles. But when you're starting, figure it out and get a good team around you. Collaborate with people.
When you're starting out, I would usually encourage people to keep things simple and try to learn what the conventions are. Rather than on your very first mix, trying to do something that's crazy and different, people aren't going to assume that you're a genius. They're going to assume you don't know what you're doing. So when you're starting out, try to be conventional. And then as soon as you get more and more control over your own material, that's when you can start to go crazy.
And by crazy, you mean creative and intelligent and well-designed. Yes.
Yes. Tom Holman has a list of commandments he made. Tom's the TH and THX sound. And the 11th commandment is, it's not there are no rules, but it's something along the lines of, if it works, it doesn't matter. Forget the rest of the rules. So, of course, you can always do something brilliant that breaks every rule. Even Bach broke his own rules many times when he was writing, but he was Bach.
Yeah, I remember I was teaching a class for you, and one of these kids asked me something about recording, and I said, I'll just tell you an example of something I thought that made the most sense to me was, I used to teach online, you know, just sort of people would ask questions about how to record, and I'd respond, and somebody wrote me and said, you know, we're recording and we're getting a lot of noise in the voiceover and in the vocals, and we wonder if you could make some suggestions of what to do. And I wrote back and said, well, tell me how you're doing it. What microphones are you using? You know, what's your signal chain? What's happening?
What's the acoustic space?
Well, yeah. And they wrote me back and they said, well, you know, we're pretty poor, and because we don't have a lot of isolation, you know, we have a VW bug and we've been using it for isolation for the for the voiceover, for recording for the vocals, and you know, it gets hot in there, so we turn the engine and the air conditioning on. And I wrote back and I said, well, cool idea. You might just want to figure out how to do your takes in between when it's getting really hot in the thing. Yeah. But I mean, it's a good idea for isolation in acoustically interesting space. So you know, they were getting good results up until the moment they had to turn the engine on.
Right.
You know.
Although, to be honest, those are pretty boxy, but they are one of the few cars that has a good amount of absorption in them.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So it could sound like a close mic. And again, as long as they're close mic, you're not going to hear the boxy sound.
I just like the inventiveness, to be honest.
Yes.
I just thought it was like, you know, great. I mean, when I was working at the record plant, I remember there was a metal stairwell in the building. It was like a 10-story metal stairwell. And we used to, on weekends when there's no one in the building, we used to put amplifiers out on the stairwell at the top of the stairs and then hang a mic down to the bottom of the stairs. And then you'd get this very long decay metal sort of plate-like reverb that you could very subtly mix in, but it was a 10-story plate.
Wow.
Because the staircases were metal, and we just chain a bunch of XLR cables together to drop the mic.
And of course, today, now people would ask, what plug-in can I do to get that effect?
Right. Yes, that is true. That is true.
Because, you know, all that work of having to place another microphone.
That's funny.
Guys,
that's
really funny. I can't drive past a silo without my wife saying, oh man, that would be so amazing for a reverb. So she's like, she would try to find the plugin to do it, but she'd rather have a mic and a bunch of cables and risk life and limb.
First of all, big points for having a wife who cares about that.
She's a recording engineer.
she loves this stuff. I have no clue what I'm doing. So,
well, I'm in that same category. So
it sounds like you know more than you're saying, Steve.
Oh, hell, I wish. But, you know, it's been a great conversation. I think that you guys have covered a lot of territory. And, you know, I don't know, like, what you guys have to do or anything. But, John, if he's got anything that he wants to promote.
John?
Well, a couple of things. My production company is twofold. I have zenavguy.com, which is just my basic services as a mixer and producer for artists, local artists, musicians, people who need films or records made about their promoting themselves or their venue or their events. And then I work with a team called ALOC Media, which is a couple of young guys that I mentored. And we own all our own gear, so we can come in and shoot 5 to 8 cameras, 4K for, you know, a live event. We just shot at the Paramount. We just shot at the Boulder Theater. And we have everything, so we can edit and mix everything up to a final mix. And then if we have to do theatrical, we can take it to a stage. And that team is something that we're focused on actually being able to provide these kinds of services for younger artists and for nonprofits and for venues that are really looking to promote themselves. And we're also always looking for interns, but I will say this because I know this is going to go out to young people. If you approach me to be an intern working for me, if you're not prepared to work for me for at least 2 years and you're not prepared to really learn from the ground up, I don't care where you went to school. Don't contact me.
I know that
sounds mean, but I need people who really want to learn the craft from the ground up.
I think that's fair.
Now, would that internship be paid?
It paid after 3 months if you're actually able to do what I need you to do without, you know, causing my clients to have stress, heart attacks, or strokes. I actually do start paying. Like I usually start people in asset management, archival, moving through basic rules of shooting, location sound. I will not put anybody in a position where they're responsible for anything until I've worked with them for at least 90 days. And right. I can know that they're trustworthy to put my clients, you know, work in their hands. And then there's a slow learning curve, but we have a whole methodology for working with people. And we're interested in people who want to learn the craft. But if you want like an expedient gig where you're just going to have something for your resume, I'm not the right guy to train with. I want to train people who want to be craftsmen, who want to actually go out and make a living and be able to do this for a long time.
Which is the traditional journeyman approach to becoming a craftsman.
Yes.
Which is perfect. It does bother me a little bit that the unpaid internships are now pretty much the only way to get into the industry. And I warn my students that when they graduate, they better save up some money because the average internship is, like you said, 90 days. And after that, they're either going to hire you or fire you. And they may not have room for you, even if you did a great job.
90 days is unreasonable, David. I mean,
No, I don't at all.
I think 90 days is nothing.
Yes. And many times I've had students who've gone through 3 or 4 internships before they finally got paid. So be prepared for living like a student for a few more years. If you haven't hit it after like 3 years, maybe that's the time to give up. Or when you run out of money. But it really takes a while to get your feet into the industry and to really become a craftsman at what you're doing.
Right. Well, think about the logic also of it is if I'm bringing you into my business and I have clients who know me and can trust me, and I put you in a room with, you know, $100,000 worth of equipment or more, and I put you on a session where your responsibilities are perfection or a really good sense of how to solve the problem if you don't know, and you fail, you're costing me business and that. So it's a relational thing where you're developing trust. And there's another side, which I'll also mention if we're going to have people listening. If you apply to be an intern with somebody or for a job with somebody, have a resume, have some letters of recommendation, have a way of being able to contact you, and don't expect the person to get back to you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like you have to be persistent. I actually had somebody from your class recently contact me, and it was like a short note. Hey man, I was in your class last year and I was wondering if there were any internships available, but no phone number, no contact, no resume, no photo, no nothing to remind me of who he is. And I wrote him back and I said, I'm not hiring right now. And if I was, to be honest, I don't know who you are or why I'd want to bring you in.
Right.
You know?
Well, I'm sorry my student was that way because that means a senior graduated without knowing how to put together a resume. But
I think he was thinking I remembered him. And I'm not critical of that. I'm just saying I come from the old school, which is you present yourself professionally, you behave professionally, and that accountability makes it so that it's easier for people to want to hire you. And 90 days, by the way, again, is not that long because my guys are making good money. And and I pay my guys really fairly because I want them to stay and then keep learning so that they get better. And then I have a team that I can count on so I can retire.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And David, what do you got going on?
So projects I'm working on, not really much at the moment. I did a short with Deborah Esquenazi, which was published on the New York Times website as an opinion. The title of the opinion piece by her was The Trauma of Sanctuary. I did the post sound for it. And the name of the short film is El Vazio, and it interviews people who are in sanctuaries, basically. Wow. People who are trapped in the United States because the minute they set foot out of their sanctuary, they'll be arrested. So I think that's an important film if you get a chance to take a look at it.
I'd love to see that.
It's only 12 minutes long.
I'll find a link to it in the show notes.
Yes. And I'm writing a book about a composer who I trained with, who was a very important composer at Berklee College of Music, but most people outside of jazz don't know who he is. Herb Pomeroy.
Oh, Herb was awesome.
Yeah. Herb ultimately became a good friend of mine.
Really? That's awesome.
Yes. Yeah.
Dude, we keep knowing so many people. This is really weird.
He had a very unique system that he taught by. And I'm trying to get it published, but there are problems with that in that nobody wants to publish a book about what they call a local musician. Mm. And academic publishing has gone into the dumpster. Every academic publisher now is there only to publish their own school's material. And CU Denver and even CU Boulder don't have their own publishing company. Mm. So I've run into a little bit of a problem there. Also, Berkeley, much to my chagrin, after giving me tremendous amounts of access to materials, one of their faculty told me, oh, by the way, you don't have the rights to that. Berkeley owns the rights to it because he created that system when he was teaching at Berkeley
yep.
in 1955, which, of course, he never signed a contract in 1955 or any other year saying they owned any intellectual property. That didn't become a thing until decades later.
He was a big influence on a lot of people. I mean, when I was there, yes. Makoto Azone was in the Herb Pomeroy big band.
Yep.
He was the producer for the recording big band, which I was a part of the recording band.
What instrument?
Guitar. I met Tommy Tedesco by playing in that band. You know, it was great. It was an amazing time. And Herb Pomeroy was there with the Vibes player. What was the Vibes player's name?
Gary Burton.
And there was just so many great musicians around him. You know, it was Herb Pomeroy was amazing.
Yes, and I would like to have his system remembered. And I know someone else is writing a biography, which is why I'm avoiding that. Anyway, that's what I've been doing over the summer. Classes start next week, so of course my entire mindset will change, or I should say 2 weeks classes start.
Well, very good. It sounds like you both have a lot going on. Well, hey guys, it was a real pleasure, and thank you so much.
Thanks.
All right, Dave, I'll talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
And Steve, thanks for having me.
By the way, could you hear my cat through the whole interview?
Just a little bit. At the end, I heard a little bit.
Yes, okay. You can leave that in or cut it out. I won't be offended.
Okay. I'm Steve Cleveland, and you've been listening to Sync Club. Check out our show notes for more information. If you have a show idea or you just want to connect, hit us up at Twitter. Username Sync Club Podcast. Thanks for the hang. We'll see you here next week at the club.